These guitars, which were an integral part of your career for more than 40 years, can you tell us why you're choosing to sell them now?
I've had a wonderful experience with these guitars, but as you know, your focus changes. My interest is so much in songwriting, and I use the piano so much for that now. And the guitars are a representation of the past, but they're also part of people's history. And I think other people have a chance to get to know them and see them and play them and enjoy them would be something very exciting. It's actually the folk process.
How many guitars do you own?
I think probably about in all 15 to 20 over the years. And then that's probably not counting my early guitars. So my first guitar was a National guitar with that big steel front. I'd have no idea where it landed in those chaotic early 60s, because I must have gotten it when I was 15 or 16 years old, paid a few bucks out of my babysitting money. The Guild was probably my first 12-string, and that was in the early 60s when I had probably heard, some of these wonderful singers that were around the village. They didn't all play the 12-string, though, and the one who played the 12-string, who wrote Once I Was? Tim Buckley. And Tim Buckley, when he came around New York and I heard his songs and I adored the way that 12-string sounded. Also, Pete played the 12-string, Pete Seeger. So when I recorded things like Turn, 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 which I recorded in 1963, I was also working with Jim McGuinn, later known as Roger McGuinn, who played the 12-string. So then I became intrigued and fascinated with the fact that you could make the whole thing sound like an orchestra. It sounded like bells and other instruments playing along with you. And I love that feeling with the 12-string. And I've more and more played the 12-string. I used to be a pretty good Travis picker. And when I was working with the 6-string, I got my first Martin probably in 1962, I think, when I came to New York. I know that I was playing a 6-string at Newport Festival in 1963, so it must have been earlier than that. And I could just finger pick like a whiz.
When we view your collection now, it looks very much a grouping of guitars that a musician would own, mm-hmm. not so much a collection.
Oh, yes, they're all for the purpose. I never collected for having them. I got some extra versions of the Judy Collins signature guitar from Martin because I love them so much, and I thought they were so beautiful. So I got a couple more 6-strings and a couple more 12-strings. But I'm mostly playing the 12-string now.
Now, you began your musical training as a classical pianist.
And, I did.
And a great foundation there in classical music. What drew you to the guitar?
The stories. The first songs that I heard on the radio, I was 14 or 15 years old, so I guess it was 54, 55, 53. And the first song I heard was called The Gypsy Rover. And it was from a movie called The Black Knight. And it was an Alan Ladd movie about King Arthur's Round Table. And the songs that they chose were traditional songs from the English, Irish, Scottish tradition. And this version of the Gypsy Rover was so wonderful. Guitars and banjos and this great story about this girl who runs off with a gypsy and into the woods. And I was just mesmerized by this song. I had only heard things like it from my father, who sang a lot of Irish folk songs. He sang a lot of I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen, and Danny Boy. And he and my godfather, Holden, used to do the Irish repertoire, and my father would play the piano. Holden would sing, or my father and Holden would sing duets. Holden was a very fine singer. He sang with the Robert Shaw Chorale, and he had his debut at Carnegie Hall. And so I was around a lot of that music, but I didn't realize what it was, because in conjunction with that, my father was singing the Great American Songbook. So I think that when I heard the Gypsy Rover, I was just floored. I thought, well, this is it. So I went down to Wells Music Store in Denver, and I bought this record of the Gypsy Rover, and I brought it home, and promptly, you know, it was like a big, very, very thin pizza in those days. It was red vinyl, and I sat on it and broke it in about 25 pieces. And so I had to get my girlfriends to turn their radios on and keep waiting to hear it so I could get the words, because I didn't have the music, I didn't have the record now. And they did, because we had a little performing group called the Little Reds. So in a way, that had sort of started it, in the sense that I needed another story. The songs also serve a purpose. And when they came along, I was ready. And I convinced my father to rent me a guitar. And he rented me this old National with 7 jazz lessons, which I took one of and then abandoned. But that's how it all started. I fiddled around and, you know, I have been blessed with or cursed with a very good ear, so I can basically play anything you play me on the piano, certainly. And the guitar, I just figured it out. And soon I had these calluses. You know, you have to work with your calluses and put up with the bloody calluses. My father tried to learn the guitar, but when he tried to learn it, of course, he got calluses and he couldn't read his Braille books anymore.
Mm. Throughout your career, you're more often than not seen playing Martin guitars.
Yes.
And can you tell us why Martins were always your sort of guitar of choice?
I think it's because the people that I admired most played Martins. And I think Pete had a Martin 12 string really early, Pete Seeger. And I met Pete Seeger in 1961 when I started recording in New York, when I was recording for Elektra, and also when Harold Leventhal became my manager. And Harold Leventhal managed practically everybody in New York, as far as I could tell. I mean, he managed the Weavers, of course, with Pete and Freddie Hellerman and Ronnie Gilbert and others. They all played 12 strings or 6 string Martins. And I admired them. If they weren't playing those, they were playing banjo, and I never even dreamed of playing banjo because it wasn't going to suit my voice, really. And talk about wild finger picking, I didn't think I could handle that. But I admired those who played the Martin, and the Martin sounded the best to me. It always had the sweetest tone. And you can play anything on a Martin guitar. You can put gut strings on a Martin guitar to have it sound like a Spanish guitar. You can play 12 string and have it sound like Pete Seeger and the Bells of Rimini. You can have a 6 string and have it play something like Turn, 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 which I did in the early years on the 6 string. And I had always admired guitar players who could make gorgeous music on a Martin. And that's what drew me. Also, the other thing was that because I guess I already played Martins, I was invited to go down to the Martin Guitar Company in Pennsylvania, even then, to open their new factory in 1964. There's a photograph, which is me and Tom Paxson standing on the loading dock at the Martin Guitar new factory, playing the guitar and singing. And I have on this little dress, and I obviously have a slip under it, and my slip is showing, which I just love. I mean, it's so not 60s, you know. Who wore a dress with a slip playing a Martin guitar? Not Johnny Cash or Maybelle Carter, that's for sure.
Do you remember that first Martin that you ever owned?
I moved to New York in 63, and it was in that spring I must have bought that Martin guitar. I was hanging around a lot in the village. I lived in the village, and there were guitar stores, and there were connections with the Martin Company. And then because of that invitation, I must have bought that Martin guitar in the village sometime in about 63. Mm-hmm. And I do remember that it was a good deal.
Mm-hmm. When you're writing and composing, what instrument do you?
For the most part, I write on the piano. I've only probably written a couple of songs on the guitar. It's just not something I do because, you know, despite the fact that I learned to play the guitar, and I could actually play pretty well, and I could, as I said, I could finger pick up a storm in the early years, but I never found the ease with the chord combinations. The only thing that I found that really has been miraculous is the detuning on the 12 string. And I was reading a quote from somebody in Sylvia Tyson's book about songwriters, and one of the songwriters she interviewed said, if I tune the guitar to a detuning, which is tuning that low E string down one note to a D, I can write anything. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of appealing to me. I thought, at this point, I think I might try that, because I've never found it easy. And yet, I have learned songs on the 12 string in a regular tuning. I sit down to practice the piano every day, and when I do that, I also have a tape recorder handy, and I have a notebook handy, and I noodle. But some of the songs I love best that I've written, I play on the guitar, even though they were written on the piano, or just written and then finally fleshed out on the guitar.
Fleshed out on the guitar, because that was going to be my next question, that process of changing the creative piece from the keyboard to the guitar.
Yes.
When do you make that choice, and how does it happen?
In the last 15 years or so, I've written a couple of songs all written out. I never used to do that, but I found myself caught up in certain experiences like the hurricane in New Orleans and the 9/11 tragedy here in New York. And in those cases, and also a song called The Fallow Way, I found myself writing them all out, writing complete lyrics In the case of Kingdom Come, going straight to the guitar, I knew it had to be played on the 12-string. It just needed that kind of orchestral guitar sound. And that's actually on this album, this new one.
The Martin 12-string from 1971, you perform both on 12-strings as well as 6-string guitars. And as a musician, what leads you, when you're going to perform a song, to reach for a 12-string?
I've recorded a lot, of course, with the 6-string guitar. All the songs in the early 60s were with my Martin 6-string. I don't think I did a record with a 12-string until probably 69 maybe or 70. I don't think I played it at all in concert until 70, 71. And I think that 71 12-string that we have, when I started working with that, I was leaning into the music of Pete Seeger and also listening to a lot of Roger McGuinn and a lot of the Byrds. A lot of that music has that feeling. Some of what comes over in those groups, those early groups, like Crosby, Stills and Nash and the Byrds, is that 12-string overtone. It's very beautiful. That combined with the harmonies. And so I think I got intrigued with listening to that and had in my mind, when am I going to move to a 12-string? So it finally happened.
Looking at the Guild from 1968,
that was my first 12-string, and that's where I was getting used to the idea of playing the 12-string. Pretty soon, I was using that 12-string all the time. I carried both at that point on my concerts. I always carried both the 6-string and the 12-string, right through probably 1977. And then I learned to get away from all guitars and put the guitar down and start singing with a band. I used to have 17 people in my band, can you believe it? 17 people on the road. Quite insane, actually, but a lot of fun. And they all were great musicians. So for a little while, I didn't play the guitar at all, except on the occasion. Then in the coming months, I brought it back, and then I brought back mostly the 12-string.
The 1939 D-28 was considered one of the most coveted guitars among collectors and performers. Can you tell us how this guitar came in your possession?
I was traveling always with great guitarists like Eric Weisberg, and he was infinitely interested in instruments, and he collects, as Stephen Stills does. And I think probably it was Eric and Stephen who convinced me to get this D-28. I admired many people who played that guitar, and so then I had really found the 6-string that I played every time I played for the next probably 8 or 10 years.
Are there specific recordings that you made with the pre-Moore Martin that you remember?
I know that the songs that we did in Who Knows Where the Time Goes, I played a lot on that guitar. And then when we recorded Whales and Nightingales, and it has Amazing Grace on it, and there were things on that album that I used that guitar with, anything I recorded between 68 and 77, I would have used the old D-28 Martin, which I love to this day. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful instrument.
You've talked a lot about your early influences, and you're obviously still doing a lot of songwriting today. Who sort of influences you now?
I go back and forth. On my latest album, there's a song by Amy Spies called The Weight of the World. It's one of the best songs I've ever heard, and it's one of the best anti-war songs that I've ever heard, and it has a real depth to it. So I'm always looking for new songwriters. But I'm also always sort of sifting through the past, too, because there were songs that influenced me that I didn't know influenced me. On the new album, there's a song that is a traditional song that's in the Child Ballad collections. And I had known it for 40 years, but I'd never sung it. I knew I would record it one of these days. I did get to it on this album. I listen to a lot of songwriters. I listen to a lot of songs. I'm always hunting. But the things that I wind up singing are often things that simply pop into my mind or pop into my life. I was practicing one day with my 12-string, and I suddenly remembered Ghost Riders in the Sky from my childhood. I mean, it came out in 1949, Vaughn Monroe. And what a perfect song. So I began to sing it and play it, you know, that last line, if you want to save your soul from hell, riding on a range, then cowboy, change your ways today, or with us you will ride, trying to catch that devil's herd. And I just fell in love with it again and got a great bunch of friends to sing on it, Jimmy Webb and Tom Paxton and Bob Neuwirth, who used to be Bob Dylan's road manager, and my brother, Denver, singing on that. So we had a great time doing that. So influences, they have an overtone of experience, of my own experience. I'm also singing Over the Rainbow, which is his children's book that just came out. And I was born in 1939, the same year that the song came out. And my mother always told me that I was named after Judy Garland. So it kind of fit. It was time for me to sing the song, despite the hundreds and probably thousands of versions of the song that exist. I also had a friendship with Yip Harburg, who wrote the song with Harold Arlen. And he was always saying to me in the 70s when I recorded Brother Can You Spare a Dime of his, he said, you have to sing my other famous song. And I would always say, no, it's not time yet. So the songs drift in and out. And then because I have 50 years of recording so many albums, there are many songs that I can pull forward, like Anesia, which I recorded, I think, on my second album. And I think the influences in the early years were guitar players who could pick, who could sing, who could play that Martin guitar. You know, I loved that gang of people that I started seeing in Denver, the folkies, oddballs, you know, eccentrics and interesting people who sang a whole slew of folk songs from every part of the world and every kind of version of songs too. And that appealed to me, all the stories. Again, it was the stories and that combination of, instead of playing with the orchestra, which I did when I was a child, when I was only a couple years younger, you could be by yourself with a guitar telling a whole story and holding everybody's attention. That got my attention. The lyrics have to be right for me or I wouldn't say them, wouldn't sing them.
The two Martin guitars that we're offering in this sale that are contemporary, they're the HD35 6-string and the 12-string. Both of these instruments were made specifically for you. Can you tell us how this project with Martin got started and what was it like working with him?
To be most frank about this, and it actually was synchronistic, as things often are in life, I had seen a piece on Stephen Stills and his relationship with Martin and how he had gone to the factory and he'd talked to Dick Boak and he'd figured out everything from exactly the wood to exactly the strings and exactly how long the neck would be and what kind of pattern would be and where would the inlays be. And I was just jealous, that's all. So I was thinking about that, and at the same time I was thinking of calling Dick Boak at Martin, he called me. And he said to me, I said, oh, that's funny, I was just thinking about you because just saw Stephen down there, you know, making a conversation about his new guitars. And he said, well, I've been thinking about you because your picture's in our anniversary book of you on the loading dock with your slip showing, playing your guitar. And he said, I'd like to make you a guitar. I'd like to come and talk to you about getting you a Martin signature guitar. There were very few women. I can't even remember how many. Joan had a Martin signature guitar, but most of the rest of them were guys. So this was kind of a watershed moment. And so he came up and he said, you play the D35, don't you? And I said, yes. He said, we could make you a D35 12 string that would just be marvelous. We'd like to tailor it to your needs and, you know, also include the idea on the guitar that you now have your record label. So we would put a Wildflower from your record label in the Mother of Pearl on the neck, probably. And so I was very excited. I don't know if Stephen has his own record label, but he certainly doesn't have a Wildflower on the neck of his guitar. So we got together and we started talking about, and I was thrilled. You know, I went down to Bethlehem. We talked about the wood and about the guitar itself, and it took quite a while, but when the prototype came, I was delighted and thrilled. And of course, Dick decided that he would do the 6-string as well. I also like what Martin does when they make a signature guitar for anyone. They ask the person whose name the guitar is made in if they will choose a nonprofit that the royalties will be given to. And in my case, I chose both Amnesty International and also UNICEF. So he splits the proceeds from those guitars between those two organizations, which is great because they're two of my favorites.
You're known for playing large dreadnought-bodied guitars, and yet there's some imagery of you playing a smaller little Martin, and you do own this quite wonderful, that you're offering in this next sale, a Triple Odd 18. When you choose a smaller-bodied guitar over another, how does that process work?
Well, it's usually because the sound is a sweet sound and it's the sound I need for a certain song. There's a song that I recorded with Eric Weisberg. It's called So Early in the Spring. It's the most beautiful duet of dancing guitars that I've heard. and two guitars just dancing along together with the notes in harmony with each other. Nothing like that when you can do that. If I'm doing turn, 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 for instance, I would use that if I wasn't using a 12 string. I would use that smaller Martin because of the sound. I can get it to sound a little bit more like a Spanish guitar. I like the single note picking sound on the 6-string. I've noticed some people can come on and off the stage with many different kinds of guitar. Usually I'll pick it for those songs, but I'll also use it so I don't have to change. It's the hair that's the problem. But so I'll stick with one guitar usually during the whole show, or if I do the intermission, then I'll switch to the other guitar. And the smaller guitar, it does add a kind of, I don't know, innocence or perhaps intimacy to the playing and to the songs that you're doing. The 12-string is a bigger kind of ferocious song, and it sounds very much more like a little orchestra up there. Whereas you might say the 6-string gives you an intimacy of just you and the music and the lyric without the orchestral 12-string sound. But I do love both. I love them all.
How do you think your classical background and training has influenced both your writing and your performance?
You know, I was at a festival last year, I guess it was in the spring, and I heard a talk by a jazz artist, a rock and roll artist, and he said people asked him how to maintain yourself in the music business, and he said you have to get tough. And I think that the classical training made me tough. It made me aware, first of all, that I wouldn't get this thing until I was about 90. You know, when you look at the great classical pianists and the great classical conductors and the great classical composers, most of them, except Mozart, who started doing things when he was 9 or something, most of them get better and better and better, and they intend to, and they act as if and live as if they're going to. So that's tough. You know, that's a toughness that's already built in. I mean, it's tough to sit down every day and have to practice a certain number of hours. And I had to do that from the time I was 5, so I was prepared for a lot of things that I was prepared for a career crisis at 14 or 15 that I might not otherwise have been prepared for, because I figured out early that it took a lot of work. My father also was tough. You know, he had a radio show every single day. He got up and got there and was on time and raised 5 kids and paid the bills and paid for everything that we did by getting up and going to work every day. And that's an incredible thing to learn how to do, to watch someone else do. And I think it also taught me that sometimes things are really terrific and sometimes things are not. Quincy Jones said, you know, it's the lean times that really teach you what you're made of. And when you go through a career that's 50 years, which is what mine is at this point, and still working on the other half, you've been through already a lot of ups and downs, and classical music training taught me that. It taught me how to practice, it taught me how to sit still for long enough to get something done and know that if it wasn't done, I could get back to it the next day. It's also the road. I think that you don't get paid for making music, you get paid for going on the road, whether you're a pianist traveling in Yugoslavia with your tuner or whether you're on the road all over the country as I am and all over the world. So I think that that's part of it. It's the lesson of endurance.
Your social activism is well documented, and you were an important voice for change in the last 50 years. How do you think music has played part in that change?
I think it plays a huge part. It does galvanize people, and it does bring people together in a way that is hard to conceive of anything else really doing. You know, political rants without music are really no fun. I think that combination of activism and music always drew people together, and it always made people feel as though they could change things. Maybe they couldn't change things immediately, but it helped in all the anti-war protests that I was involved with and all the activism that I was involved with and still am. You can't really do a benefit for some organization unless you get up and sing. And by the way, that's something else that I learned at the feet of my father, because he did so many free shows for different causes, and whether it was going to fundraisers for the Salk vaccine, which we did, and I was trotted to that event with him, or doing shows for, you know, the Christmas show, which raised money to buy presents for the children of people who didn't have as much as we had. And the idea that you always have to give back, that was also fundamental. And I think most musicians know that because they have to do certain things for free, and they have to do certain things that give back to the culture, to the causes they believe in. to the things in their community that need help. And I, so I think it's just part of the fabric of being an entertainer. But being a folk singer makes you even more prone to that, because then you're involved with an issue of social change overall. And we were part of something that was changing. It was changing from the 50s. It was very different in the 50s. Not that people didn't have their favorite causes, but that politics and music came together because people had the scales fell from their eyes, as it were, and they began to realize that the government lied to them and that nobody was telling them the truth and that they were going to have to do it. They were going to have to make the change. And I think one of the most exciting, moving things I ever did was to go to Mississippi in the summer of 1964, as so many of us did. And I traveled briefly with Fannie Lou Hamer. That was an inspiration. And going into neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods, where people were terrified. You know, people were dying and getting beaten up and getting brutalized, and people were frightened. And she was such a powerful example. And she would get people out of their houses and sing "This Little Light of Mine, I'm Going to Let It Shine." And I just gained a lot of strength from her, as well as feeling in some way that I was making a difference. The difference was made, and the world is a different place today. And I think that's because of all the activism that was going on and that is going on. You know, it never ends. There are so many issues today that beg for attention.
Do you think music does play a role in that social change?
I was singing somewhere for some group recently, and I sang this new song by Amy Spies. And it's about a girl whose brother's going off to war. Where, we don't know. She doesn't say, but she does talk about deserts and bombs and the brother not coming home. And a couple of days later, this guy called me and said, "You know, I used to be a Republican." And after I heard that song, you know, how can I go on like this? I have to be active about this. And I think most of us feel that way. What we can do, I don't know. But perhaps to be aware and to shed a few tears. One of the things we have to remember is that the vets who came back from Vietnam were not well treated in this country by hardly anyone. And I think that's so big a shift now. And I think it's in part because we realize we have to support these troops. They're over there doing something I may not agree with, but they're doing this and giving their lives. And I think that the more we're aware of what's going on, I always think information and reality and the truth are awfully good motivators for people to get active in their lives in whatever that means, in every way that means. My life has been one of making art. I feel that it's a service that I do. I feel that it is something that is vital to people, that taking art to people's lives is something that sometimes saves their lives and allows them to make choices they might not be able to make without the music. And I've always felt that. I think it's live music changes people's minds, changes their view of themselves. The music may be one kind or another, and particularly with songs that are story songs, that really get you thinking about your own interior vision of what your life is about. It's very important to hear that. I have that experience when I go to hear music. So I know people have that when they come to see me. I'm trying to think of the word that the reviewer used in England one time about going to a concert of mine, and he said, "You come away scarred." I think that's right. You have to be reached. And music that I prefer to go and hear is music that is thoughtful and is mind-changing and that allows me to dwell inside my own conscience and figure things out a little better than I could without it. I think that's the reason that Leonard Cohen's music has suddenly come back with such a huge force, because people want to be thoughtful. They want to think about it. Enough screaming and yelling and ranting and raving. I think people need that calm in order to kind of readjust and have a break from some of the noise in the world.